Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Dean Mitchell. Please grab a comfortable seat with your favorite listening device or your viewing device. And if you're driving, fasten your seatbelt because you're about to enter the smartest doctor in the room. Today, I have on two outstanding specialists that are going to tell us about the latest breakthrough in long COVID research. Yes, COVID is still going on. It's in its fourth year. And although I would say in quotes, the train has slowed a bit, it's still on the tracks. Life is going on. However, there are a subset of the population that's been infected and has developed long COVID. And for those people, the agony continues, which really is a tragedy. And I know in my own practice in New York, I've seen many cases of this. Doctors, nurses, just the general public. This past year, though, I got super excited. A team of about 40 researchers at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania published, in my estimation, a groundbreaking paper identifying specific findings in these long COVID patients. And it's interesting, it probably is going to apply to some other kind of chronic viral diseases and maybe even chronic Lyme. And we're going to talk about not just the findings, because again, everybody gets their hopes of, oh my God, they found this new thing and that thing. And then they're like, well, what does that mean? I'm actually going to present some ideas I have for targeted treatment. And I'd be interested to hear what my guests today think about that as well. So Dr. Mayan Levy is an immunologist who heads her own lab, the Levy Lab at Penn. And Dr. Benjamin Abramoff is a physician who heads the Long COVID Center at Penn. They are both part of the team that published this important paper, which we're going to show, and I'm really excited to get into the details. So I'm so pleased to welcome Drs. Levy and Abramoff to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having us.
All right, great. Thanks for taking the time today. I really want to dive into right away. Usually, like, we make a little small talk. There's no time for small talk with this. I want to prelude this with something before we get into your paper, because I pulled something else out from another, it was from the New York Times, but it was from another Cell paper. And they found four factors that lead to long COVID. Now, I know that's not exactly what you addressed in your paper, but I just was curious, maybe either one of you, your opinion. The four factors were high levels of RNA from the coronavirus early on. Okay, and then I'm just curious what they consider a high level. If patients developed autoantibodies similar to lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, and again, I'm not sure what they meant in that. They didn't specify. Do they mean ANA levels? Mm-hmm. They also talk about, and I've heard this in other papers as well, reactivation of the Epstein-Barr virus, which, you know, there's so much misinformation about that, because even many patients that come to me with chronic fatigue, they go, I have Epstein-Barr. And we explained to them, everybody's been exposed to Epstein-Barr. But apparently, with COVID and probably some other viruses, Epstein-Barr does get reactivated like a herpes virus can be. And I want to talk to you again about, I guess it's the early antigen D, like how do researchers, you know, doctors pinpoint that? And the last factor was obviously a circulatory issue, like with type 2 diabetes. So I guess my question is, when you were even looking at your paper and what Dr. Brahm, if you've seen the long COVID clinic, are you stratifying these patients and saying, yes, this person would probably meet the criteria for, you know, because again, like when I'm in my practice, I'm obviously looking for certain risk factors. Like when I'm looking for immune dysregulation, like a lot of times it could be they've been on oral steroids for a long time or antibiotics. So anyway, go ahead and give me what you think.
Yeah, I think this highlights a very key element when we think about long COVID patients and the long COVID pathology. And it's really, to me, even more so, to treatments, is where are the biomarkers? How can we use things in the blood to identify who has long COVID and who doesn't? And almost as important, and I think what will turn out to be likely, is it's not all one big group of everybody having the exact same course, because that doesn't make sense with what we see clinically. It's a very heterogeneous condition, right? And we see patients with autoimmune type phenotypes with pain and Raynaud's syndrome, and we see other patients with a really clear dysautonomia type picture, and then we have some that are, the fatigue is really heavy, and I personally don't believe that it's all going to be one pathophysiologic pathway for each of the patients. And, you know, even in every study, it's not 100% of the patients that have a certain phenotype. It's a certain percentage. And I think one analogy I like to think about is that when we think of like rheumatologic diseases, a lot of them can on the surface look like they have similar appearances, but we know now after many years there's different autoantibodies that are involved in these different conditions, and I think we're going to see a very similar endpoint with long COVID, maybe not for a little while yet, where we'll take our long COVID patients, and whether that's through deep immune phenotyping or looking at specific biomarkers, whether that's serotonin levels or it's vascular clotting markers, and we'll get a better picture of like, well, you're actually more specific in this cohort, and that's how we're going to treat you. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult to do that based on symptoms. And there's been a lot of attempts to do that based on kind of how do we cohort patients based on symptoms, and it really hasn't been clinically useful. It's going to, in my mind, it's going to come down to these the pathophysiologic studies that we're doing.
Well, let me ask you one thing, because again, this might be a big leap, but it's almost like, again, fortunately today, COVID in general is not considered how it was in that first wave when it was really so deadly, so scary. But today, still a lot of people run to urgent care centers. You know, they have a sore throat, they're coughing, they get tested for COVID, they go, you got COVID, and then we'll get to decide whether Paxlovid or not, et cetera. But can you foresee at some point where there's like a blood test or something to try to get, like we said in this, like the viral load, or to know who's really at risk for a dangerous long COVID? I mean, obviously sometimes when they end up in the hospital, again, there's good likelihood they may have a high load. So that's going to be, I mean, obviously you would stratify a patient that, okay, the patient was hospitalized for COVID. Now we got to get into gear to try to prevent long COVID, which we're going to get into. But do you think at an even more primary level at some point we're going to be able to early differentiate, or that's just probably too hard?
I think there's a lot of challenges in that, to be honest. I think one is just really hard to, given the amount of people who get mild COVID infections, to do any type of prospective study to see those markers early on is going to be really challenging.
I got it.
Maybe in the context of when we know more about long COVID, we can kind of think back and then use that to kind of build biomarkers. I think that'd be challenging. Okay. And we may get a little bit better at kind of figuring out some of the risk factors, but even to this day, the risk factors are kind of soft, you know. And
it's not necessarily the sicker patients who go on and develop long COVID, right? So, you know, many of the patients that don't fully recover are the patients that are kept at home. They will not be at any urgent care center. So how are you going to screen them?
Right. Good point. Okay, let's go on to your paper, which is, to me, was so important. I'm kind of going a little crazy about this because obviously, like you guys, I read a lot of medical journals. And the nice thing about today, actually, medical journals today versus years ago, the graphics are beautiful. I mean, they're colorful. They bring out the point. Because sometimes, you know, you read a very technical paper, and even as a physician, I'm looking and trying to find and put it all together. You guys really put it all together. So, Dr. Levy, I'm going to go to you on this one. You know, for our listeners, and we're going to put it up now, if we can, the diagram that I want the viewers to be able to see. And for those listening, you can probably follow along as well. But this diagram, to me, really crystallizes the essence of this really important paper. So I really would like to go through this with you, Dr. Levy and Dr. Abramov, if you could jump in also at any time you want. Because, you know, honestly, I've taken this paper and made it into a handout where I'm actually showing my patients where I think down the line I'd like to target therapy. So could you take us through the diagram a little bit, and then I might jump in because to clarify some things.
Sure.
And if you can, a little bit in layman's terms.
Yeah, sure. So just maybe a two-sentence summary about our study and how we started.
Sure.
So like Ben mentioned, there is currently no biomarker that will, you know, will tell a physician or a patient, do you actually have long COVID, you don't have long COVID. Right. So what we ask is whether there is a metabolite signature that we can identify in patients that are during the acute phase of infection, and then whether this same or different metabolite signature is also present in patients with long COVID. And when we performed this metabolomic study, what we found is that one of the metabolites that was altered during the acute phase of infection and stayed altered in patients with long COVID is the neurotransmitter serotonin.
That is so important. I mean, it's so important. Okay, because I don't think I've seen that in, I mean, maybe it's existed, but I did not see that in any, you know, kind of reports coming out about that. But can I ask you one quick question on that too, sure, as we get to more things? Serotonin, which a lot of the public is familiar with, like serotonin uptake inhibitors, you know, for anxiety and depression. But, you know, it isn't, like as you said, a neurotransmitter, meaning it's a chemical that's going between neurons. And obviously there is, I guess, a blood level of that. Is it, I've always had the impression those are very hard things to measure. Did you do a special kind of measurement to get that serotonin accurately, if you wouldn't mind sharing that?
Yeah, sure. So the, you are very, it's very true that it's hard to measure serotonin, and you, the majority of serotonin is, first of all, it's produced in the gastrointestinal tract in a specialized cell of a type of epithelial cell. And the other thing that is important to know is that the majority of serotonin is not circulating freely in our blood, but it's stored in platelets. So depending on the method of blood collection and handling of the sample, the amount of platelets can differ between different samples. So it's really important to make sure that you collect the blood in the same way throughout the study, or even when we compare a certain study to other previously done studies. So yes, it is hard to measure. It's possible to measure. You can measure it in multiple methods, including ELISA, HPLC, mass spec. But yeah, I think that's the key is how you handle the sample.
Does it also matter too that I'm not even sure if there's like a circadian rhythm to it? Did it have to be collected at the same time in each patient?
Yeah, it's I saw that. So there are some studies that do report that there is some circadian fluctuation of serotonin. So I would, within a study, it's important to make sure that all the samples are collected around the same time of the day. It's a good point.
All right. And one other last thing too, just for, again, patients that I would see or other doctors that are even listening to this would see, if they draw a sample and send it to a typical, you know, commercial lab like Quest or LabCorp, not going to cut it.
No,
okay. It's okay. I mean, I wanted to get an idea. Sometimes people want said on that. Okay, I'm sorry. Go on about, that was obviously one of your key findings. There was a couple of other ones, obviously, but go ahead.
Yeah, so the maybe if we start from the left side of the diagram, this viral infection, viral RNA.
Yes, that's where I'd love to start, because I think that's where, if you follow the diagram, that's what really brings out the importance. So go ahead, because first thing is something really key. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, so when someone is infected by different viruses, our immune system is being activated. And as a result of this activation, there is a secretion of different cytokines, including type 1 interferons that are these green dots there. And what we found is that under regular conditions, when an individual is healthy, these type 1 interferons, they do a few things, including control of platelets and different activities of epithelial cells. But what is happening in the case of infection is that these type 1 interferons are inhibiting, first of all, on the top part of this blue area of the diagram, you can see that type 1 interferons, they inhibit the uptake of dietary tryptophan. And it's important because tryptophan is the amino acid which serves as the precursor for serotonin production. So when type 1 interferons are produced after viral infection, there is basically inhibition of this entire machinery that is responsible for taking up tryptophan from the diet and produce serotonin. So this is one reason for why after viral infection, or in the case of long COVID, there is reduction in the levels of serotonin, just because less tryptophan is now available to make it. On the other hand, or maybe an additional explanation for what we see is that type 1 interferons, they also control the activity or the number of platelets. And as I mentioned, platelets are the storing units of serotonin. So if we have less platelets, then less serotonin is now stored in these cells and more of it is being degraded because serotonin that is not in platelets is rapidly degraded. So now we have, on one hand, we have less production of serotonin because we have less uptake of tryptophan into the cells, but there are also less platelets that are able to store serotonin. So the serotonin that is produced is rapidly being degraded. If we continue on to the diagram on the right side...
Yeah, go because I'm going to come back to some important things. Yeah. Go ahead.
So you can see that serotonin is acting on a nerve that is called the vagus nerve that connects the gut to the brain.
Yes. Just so you know, like a lot of my listeners, if they've been following the podcast, we've done a couple of really important podcasts on the importance of the vagus nerve and the vagus nerve and the immune system on vagal mm-hmm. nerve stimulation, which we'll get into, but yeah, go ahead. So
what we found is that because there is reduction in serotonin level, there is reduced activation of the vagus nerve. And as a result, there is impairment of memory. Which is huge.
Symptoms. I just want to stop you for a second too, because again, like so many patients with long COVID, you know, complain about brain fog or, you know, mm-hmm. cognition issues. And, you know, honestly, before COVID, and we'll get into this, sometimes I saw patients with chronic fatigue syndrome or some other, what I call microbiome dysbiosis or imbalances mm-hmm. that complained of brain fog. And of course they were unfortunately dismissed by their physicians. Like this is a nonsense thing, but you're really pointing out why that could be happening.
Yeah, I think to your point that the microbiome dysbiosis is one of the hypotheses behind long COVID was a dysbiotic microbiome. So it's possible that what we found is just another explanation for that. Mm-hmm. But I think that microbiome dysbiosis will definitely
that's your like expertise too. Okay, yeah. I want to back up, but you did a beautiful job explaining that. I hope our viewers appreciate, you know, the elegance of this, and we'll get to a couple of things because I think find it fascinating. You'll be able to find these connections. But the first part I want to emphasize to the listeners and the viewers, because it's something I've been talking about for a while, and I actually interviewed Amy Prohl, who's mm-hmm. up in Cambridge, who does a lot of work on chronic fatigue and now COVID. Mm-hmm. When you show in your diagram the virus infecting the cell, okay, mm-hmm. what I try to explain to my patients, because they're very confused, is, and I believe I'm correct on this, that they're not really actively infected at that point anymore, because they're not going to infect mm-hmm. somebody else.
Sure.
But what's happening is this cell has probably, like you might show, fragments of the RNA from the virus, and that's irritating the cell to secrete interferon. Is that correct?
Exactly. Right? Yeah, that's correct.
And the way I like to explain it to patients as well is interferon is what we call an immune hormone, a cytokine. And when we even get colds, you know, when you get sick, that's certain types of interferon, correct? Like when you feel achy and jointy, but that's usually self-limited to a few days. But when you're dealing with whether it's chronic Epstein-Barr activation or COVID, possibly Lyme, I would say, for the, you know, the spirochete Lyme, would that interferon ongoing, because it seems like the cell is sending out a message like we're not in good shape here, and then that's starting to cause the cascade of the other things that you describe. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that in patients with long COVID, at least in a subset of individuals that we looked at,
yes,
in about 30% of the patients we tested, we could indeed find a viral reservoir in stool samples, suggesting that there is some viral reservoir specifically in the gastrointestinal tract. Mm. And this viral RNA can then trigger some immune response that is ongoing.
It's not like an
constantly.
Active infection. It's not like,
no, it's not. People, it's
right,
viral.
People get very confused and they,
not,
you know,
not live virus. Yeah.
Now, how did you figure out this amazing thing, unless you have a lot of experience with this, that by the interferon was going to lower the tryptophan absorption? Was that an educated guess, or you just did a whole screen of amino acids and that happened to be the one that was low?
Exactly.
Really?
Yeah, so we did a screen of many different amino acids. Mm-hmm. So tryptophan was not actually the only amino acid that was altered. We found that there is reduced level of different neutral amino acids mm-hmm. because these are the amino acids that are transported using a specific set of transporters. Mm-hmm. And when we performed RNA sequencing, that allows us to look at the transcription profile on specifically on intestinal epithelial cells, and the specific these specific transporters were downregulated.
Okay.
Okay.
The other like last thing, so there's a lot of fascinating things we could get into, but I'm extremely interested from my immunology background on the vagus nerve stimulation issue, because I think it's been way under misunderstood or not, you know, really looked at. But so how did you figure out also that it looks like, am I reading this right, that the 5-hydroxytryptophan or something is affecting the vagus nerve to underregulate it? Is that the right?
No, so what I think is happening is that on the vagus nerve, there are different receptors for serotonin. And what is happening is that on regular, you know, when a person is having a regular or normal levels of serotonin, serotonin stimulates the vagus nerve through these receptors. And because there, at least in long COVID patients, there is reduction in serotonin level, there is less activity of this receptor now. So less serotonin activates.
And how are you measuring? How are you measuring the vagus nerve?
Vagal activity.
You can measure that.
Staining. Yeah. So we've performed both in vitro studies of cultured neurons, and we stimulated them with serotonin. We could see that they are getting activated. Mm-hmm. We also measured vagal activity in mice. We have not done this in humans.
Right. I remember reading that.
You can look at gene expression in different regions of the brain, as well as immunofluorescence staining, an indication for vagal activity.
Okay. I think this diagram is amazing, and we're going to get into a couple of targeted things that I'm suggesting, and I really want to hear your opinion, and maybe it's going on in trial somewhere. But before I do that, I wanted to ask Dr. Abramoff something before he gets on the sidelines too much. There are other things that I've seen reported here and there about in long COVID that seem to make sense, like low cortisol levels, and we talked about before the reactivation of Epstein-Barr virus. You know, to me, some of this starts to make sense because when I think about any kind of chronic illness, and I think unfortunately it's very difficult to measure and underdiagnosed again, not misdiagnosed, is that, you know, a lot of these things can cause some form of adrenal insufficiency, I think. And, you know, the people have talked about giving some of these patients like cortisol supplementation. So I just was thought your opinions before we go back to the diagram about some of these other findings and do they need to, you know, are they being seen enough that they need to be addressed?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of considerations here. One, you know, when we look at different findings on all these studies that have come out looking at blood markers and pathophysiologic markers, one of the questions is what's upstream, what's downstream? You know, what is an effect of something like increased interferons, which is the effect of persistent viral infection, and what's a, you know, more downstream effect when, you know, you have persistent interferon responses? Does that cause something like adrenal insufficiency? Now, and then the other question is, when we look at big populations, we may see some things that are statistically significant, but how do we translate that clinically? And, you know, for example, for the cortisol, we've looked at cortisol in a lot of our patients, and it's very, very unusual for them to be outside of the normal range on things like 8 a.m., you know, cortisol tests.
Right, right.
And then it's that maybe is there still, we don't have a pre-COVID baseline for most of these patients. So we don't know, you know, has there been a relative decrease and what is clinically significant and what's not. And we've also had patients that have been, you know, treated with empiric steroids, particularly early on as a way to treat long COVID, and really it hasn't demonstrated that efficacy. So I think it's a few things. One, unfortunately, when we're thinking, and this applies a little bit to our study as well, when we're thinking about repurposing drugs or using things like steroids, it's really hard to get the support to do the studies to really look at those in a real objective way, as opposed to something like a new drug or pharmaceutical company back study. And I think that's something that we always have to kind of consider as we're thinking about these treatments, and where are the opportunities to repurpose things that have already been shown to be effective in different conditions or shown to have pathophysiologic basis that we can really think to build treatments based off of.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, I want to go into This is Dr. Mitchell's theory of targeted approach. So feel free with your background to shoot me down. But I've really been seriously considering, you know, and I'm starting to, you know, try this with patients because it is a little bit like repurposing things from other types of conditions I've treated. And as you know, in medicine, you know, a lot of times with the beautiful work that you guys did, but sometimes till a therapy comes available, it could be 5 or 10 years. And of course, no patients want to wait that long when they're suffering. Okay, so the first part I'm going to ask you, my targeted approach to this was dealing with the release of the interferon, you know, from these, we'll call them agitated cells. Now, I do know, again, in my immunology background, something like gamma globulin can help inhibit interferon. And a lot of times I've used it actually intramuscularly, not IV, because we're not trying to replace the person's full immune system as I would in patients I used to see that had, you know, immune deficiencies. There are probably other drugs that do it as well, too. I'm not like, you know, one of the conspiracy theorists because I never wrote a prescription for ivermectin. But I just wonder now that some of these medications that were, quote, reported to be working, whether or not they were reducing the interferon. So what's your thoughts, you know, in targeting the blocking of this interferon, the first step?
Yeah. I think that is a very reasonable hypothesis. And I think it's something that we have discussed internally in terms of drugs that block interferons. Would that be an approach that we'd want to take? I think, you know, as we think about all treatments for long COVID, it's all about kind of risk benefit analysis, mm-hmm, right, and also a little bit of low hanging fruit.
Right.
And the risk of many of the medications that tend to block interferons tend to be higher than I think some of the other targets that we're thinking about approaching first.
Okay. Okay. Cause yeah, that to me is kind of like the initiator of all the other bad stuff that ends up going on. Okay. Let's talk about like sort of step two. Now, dietary tryptophan is not being absorbed. So it would make, and they tell people that are on SSRIs to take actually hydroxytryptophan, but again, this comes back to some of my background in sublingual treatments because I've been doing that for 25 years. Would it make sense? I mean, if your gut's not really absorbing it, that you should take a preparation sublingually, you know, to bypass the intestinal or, you know, the liver first pass effect. Mm-hmm. Would that make sense versus just a person saying, I'm going to take some more tryptophan? I mean, they're, you know, the doctors Levy and Abramoff show that, is, you know, the patients with long COVID could have low. I mean, what's the danger of taking more tryptophan? Except it might not be working if there's obviously some mechanism where their intestinal cells are not able to process and absorb it.
Mm-hmm. So my opinion on this is that, like you said, taking tryptophan will not necessarily work because what we think is actually happening is it will just mean that more tryptophan will accumulate in the intestinal lumen. It will not be taken up into the cell. So I don't think that this will necessarily help. And increasing tryptophan levels too much can be toxic. So I think that maybe using serotonin precursor, like 5-HTP, might work.
That's what I meant. Okay, so something like 5-HTP. Yeah. They can get over the counter. I just want to be careful. Exactly. I want the listeners to know. But what I'm asking, though, too, is if they were to take that, I'm not even sure of the dosage, but would you recommend like a sublingual, you know, or even maybe down the line injectable, because will it get absorbed if their gut is already having this issue from the interferon?
Yeah.
Yes,
Remind you first.
No, I'm not sure how 5-HTP is being absorbed in the gut, but I don't think it uses the same transporters that we found to be downregulated. So to the best of my knowledge, I don't see a reason why it would not be absorbed.
Okay.
There are a few clinical trials that did use 5-HTP for different reasons. So the dosing could be guessed from that. But again, this doesn't, I don't have any evidence in our hands.
Okay. Yeah. What about also, again, I might be completely off on this, you know, the serotonin uptake inhibitors, I mean, a low dose or something too. Would that make sense to boost the serotonin levels in these patients, which is maybe, as we're going to get to the next step, affecting their vagus nerve. The vagus nerve. I know we're talking theoretically. I'm not holding anything, you know, just
No, these are all things that we are actively thinking about.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So it's not crazy to think of, again, you're dealing with really sick patients whose lives have been totally disrupted, who are mm-hmm. desperate and sometimes doing things that don't make any, you know, have no medical support. Whereas something like the kind of the work that you guys mm-hmm. are doing are at least like leading a path to how do we get some type of relief?
Yeah. And I'd be just very conscious that we're not at the stage yet of kind of making clinical recommendations drugs to take based on the study or anything like that. But I think it does definitely give us things to think about, like, you know, SSRIs. We know that SSRIs are not, and serotonin reuptake inhibitors are not a magic bullet for this. But, mm-hmm. you know, I think where it gets really interesting is like, well, maybe there's a subset of patients that have particularly low serotonin levels that, you know, we measure as part of our, studies moving forward. And we have these biomarkers built into the studies, or they have viral persistence that is seen. And those patients do really well. Because when you take all long COVID patients and in any study, you kind of clump them together, you're going to dilute any effect if it's not for everyone. So I think we're actively, as Mayan said, having these conversations and really thinking about this as the next step. And we've talked about this even within the last few days, kind of taking these steps.
Yeah. I mean, it's so important. You know, people are desperate. I know here in New York, people have gone to the center at Mount Sinai because they have a center for long COVID. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's been a lot of collecting information. There's never really been any kind of specific recommendations, which is, it's really very frustrating for the patients. And I'm sure I know, look, you guys as clinicians, researchers do such important work. But at the end of the day, people will seek out somebody offering, you know, an immediate treatment option. All right, let's go to the third component of this, which I think is important, as I said, has really gotten a lot of my attention and interest, is the vagus nerve issue. Now, I've actually done two podcasts with two outstanding people. One, Peter Stites, he used to be at Johns Hopkins, now he's in practice in New Jersey. He was like one of the people that actually led the way with the external vagal nerve stimulators. He has a device mm-hmm. called GammaCore, which I've used with patients, you know, trying for different reasons, where they hold it up against their neck for a couple of minutes. It looks like a little electric razor to stimulate the vagus nerve. And it's been approved FDA for migraines, but we're exploring a lot of other things with it. And I actually had on a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Dave Rabin, who was very interesting. He was he's a neurology psychiatry researcher. He was at Pittsburgh, and he ended up starting his own company for a device called Apollo Neuro, which is actually a wearable that sends pulsations that apparently gets to the vagus nerve. So, again, sorry to hold you to this, but what do you think about something, again, trying with these patients to upregulate the vagus nerve? Mm-hmm. You're telling me everything in this diagram, like the end result is the vagus nerve may be suboptimal.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting possibility. It's also something that we've thought about, to stimulate the vagus nerve. Mm-hmm. It's not something that we've tested, but I think that if what we say is correct, then vagal stimulation could maybe, you know, some of the patients can benefit and improve their symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those things that a lot of patients seek out, and we just mm-hmm. don't have the evidence yet to know whether it's helpful or not. And then there's people who are kind of offering it in ways that, you know, may not be quite as systematic maybe as we'd like. And, we want to make sure that if patients are going to be getting a treatment, at least we're looking at the data behind it. And hopefully, you know, it leads to learnings that are helpful for patients moving forward.
Yeah. You know, just one note on this. I have to point this out. Like my first year of doing the podcast, I actually had the super privilege of interviewing Dr. Kevin Tracy, who's the head of the mm-hmm. Feinstein Institute. Dr. Tracy, to me, is one of the pioneers. And I always teased him. I said, he really should win the Nobel Prize. He did the research, probably going back 20 years, on the vagus nerve's effect on the immune system, which people, again, never connected. You know, neurology was one path, immunology was another section, and he found that cross connection. And what happened was, it was actually reported in an article I read in Scientific American many years before, where, that was a lot more invasive. They were actually going in and stimulating the vagus nerve, you know, through a surgery. And a couple of the patients that were just incredible, they had, some of them had these severe rheumatologic diseases, like they'd failed every biologic and everything you can imagine and had tremendous response. Now, again, this is not everybody, but it was quite fascinating. And that's what kind of led to, I think, this whole new area now of vagal nerve stimulation and maybe the role it may play, you know, in medicine. So, so anyway, I love this work that you did. I think it's incredible. Just to kind of, as we're winding down a little bit, Dr. Abramoff, in your center, do you deal with like chronic fatigue or chronic Lyme patients or not really?
So we end up, because there's so much overlap with the long COVID patients that we see, and long COVID in a lot of ways is not distinct from chronic fatigue syndrome. For most of there are patients who do not have chronic fatigue and have long COVID, but we do deal with them, and patients can see us for those issues.
You're offering or trying to do with these patients that you find you could recommend in general or what they should look into?
Yeah, I mean, that's a loaded question because we have a lot that we offer, you know, offer these patients. But, you know, at the end of the day, and I say this, you know, to my patients when I see them the first time, we still, for the most part, not 100%, primarily focus on treating symptoms and how do we make you feel better on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's what Mayan and her team and Christoph and Sarah, what we're all trying to do is not just treat symptoms, but get to things that treat underlying pathophysiology. Because at the end of the day, that's what patients want.
Right.
They want, and I think we want as providers to be able to treat, you know, the cause and not just the effects of the disease.
Yeah, you know, you bring up something really important, by the way, too, because one of the, to me, the most devastating symptoms I've been seeing in my practice with these patients is two conditions, is the postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, which is crazy. I mean, I've seen nurses and doctors, you know, where they've had to stop working because their blood pressure just starts to shoot or their heart rate shoots up crazy. And the other thing is something called mast cell activation, which I think was a diagnosis that we didn't really recognize even in my background in allergy for decades. We just thought some of these patients with chemical sensitivities were crazy, but COVID was really a game changer because, as we know, the virus affects the monocytes and the mast cells, which are primary immune defenders. And, you know, with all the histamine and other allergy inflammatory products that get released from these mast cells, I've seen patients that never had an allergy in their life and now are only eating four foods because everything else triggers a reaction. So I don't know if you guys are seeing that as well, but it's quite alarming. And, you know, trying to do everything we can to stabilize them, you know, to have a better quality, you know, of life.
Yeah.
Dr. Levy, I wanted to ask you one other thing too, because I was looking when I was preparing for this too, that, I mean, your research besides this seems so interesting. You're a big focus of yours is the gut microbiome. Anything you can add on how any of us can strengthen our immune system or, you know, anything that you do secretly you can tell us, you know?
Yeah. So, a big focus of my lab is microbiome and microbial metabolites. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to identify metabolites that could be used as new diagnostic tools and as new treatments for different diseases. So we've applied a similar approach here in long COVID, but we are also exploring the use of diet and metabolites in other intestinal and non-intestinal diseases, such as colorectal cancer. For example, we found that you could, when we feed a specific diet to mice, it can protect them from developing colorectal cancer. It can even treat existing tumors.
Really? Wow.
And we found that it's a specific metabolite that is produced after we eat these diets that is able to reduce the proliferation of intestinal epithelial cells.
You know what that sounds like? It's so interesting. Many years ago, he was a researcher at Johns Hopkins. I'm really blanking on his name a little bit, but he's the one who promoted the whole thing with broccoli. He found, you know, that broccoli produces the sulforaphane or something, you know, and it was very good for the broccoli industry.
It's not tryptophan?
What's that?
It's not tryptophan and broccoli?
No, I think it's sulforaphane because apparently, like in the liver, there's like this two-phase reaction that can sometimes stimulate cancers or something. I thought it was fascinating. I know, you know, for a while he got a lot of, you know, pushback, but Paul Talalay, that was his name, Paul Talalay. If you ever want to look it up, it's very interesting. I mean, he did pretty heavy duty research, you know, at Hopkins showing the biochemistry of how a cancer can develop. And, you know, he fed, you know, he did, he also worked in mice and everything too, showing the sulforaphane was increased, I believe, in patients that were fed like organic broccoli, you know, the sprouts. So but what I you're saying that, seems, you know, look, everybody, of course, the holy grail is finding what's the right diet that's going to make me healthy and not get cancer.
Exactly. And, but what you're saying is a diet that is promoting cancer. Or in diet that will increase cancer susceptibility, right?
No. Sulforaphane was protective. That's why eating the broccoli, you know, again, a lot of these things is interesting. I'm sure they increase the fiber and the intestinal motility. But no, he found that actually the broccoli stimulated production of sulforaphane, and that was protective against certain kind of cancers. I forgot which one. Okay.
The diet that we found is a ketogenic diet.
Really?
Protective. Yeah.
Oh, well, people, a lot of my listeners are going to like that. Yeah. A lot of people are interested in that. That's interesting. Wow. All right. Well, I mean, this has been incredible. I mean, I hope my listeners appreciate it as much as I've been super excited about getting to talk to both of you. As we conclude, either one of you, what hope can we give to long COVID sufferers? What's on the horizon?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's been way too long without, you know, clinical trials, really looking at treatments. There's a lot that are starting, that are begun, that are about to begin. And this is certainly the next phase. I know there's a lot of disappointment out there that not more has been done to date, but, you know, research in academic settings, is mine and I can attest to, is slow. There's a lot of, you know, barriers that go along with it. And, you know, I think as a community, a research community, you know, we want to get the answers here, and there's continuing to be work. And I think we are going to get to the point where we're not, in my opinion, my strong opinion, we're not just treating symptoms. We're going to be treating underlying pathophysiology in the future.
That's important. Dr. Levy, anything you think of?
I think that at least from the, you know, the patients that I've interacted with, the main issue or the main complaint is that when they are seen by a physician, they don't believe them. So I think that if we could develop a test or, you know, an array of tests that we can then, you know, look at patients, say, okay, you most likely have long COVID or you don't have long COVID. I think that this can be very helpful for many.
You know, that's such an important point, because I've had sometimes colleagues of mine, you know, take me aside, you know, they call me up. They say, you know, I have this patient with long COVID. Is there any markers or something? Because I'm not sure I believe them. And it's, you know, and it's a little heartbreaking, but, you know, I guess doctors get jaded too, you know. You know, one last thing also too is that, I mean, one of the things, and somebody I interviewed a while back, Nancy Klemar, I think she's at Miami or in Florida. It seemed at the time, even a couple of years ago, a lot of money was pouring into this research. Is that still true, or is it like everything else in healthcare, like money gets diverted? Is there a lot of funds available for this? You're smiling. That sounds like a bad smile.
No, there is not in my
opinion.
There is
not. Wow. That's really disheartening. Because, you know, one of the things I said this twice in my career. I trained in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when there was the AIDS epidemic. And it was brutal. You know, I went through my residency in New York. But I kept on saying in the back of my mind that I really hope through all this suffering, some amazing discoveries are going to be made about the immune system. Because literally AIDS was like, it's almost like it was like manufactured the way it just destroyed the immune system. And, you know, you start to see all the ways that, you know, it affected it, that hopefully, and it taught us all about T cell markers and everything that. And more recently, I said to myself, my only wish out of this nightmare is that from long COVID and this whole coronavirus, that again, we make some kind of super significant breakthroughs that will help patients with other chronic diseases related to infections.
I think it will.
You do.
I really think it. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to learn a lot more about chronic illness and chronic fatigue and dysautonomia from the research that's coming out of long COVID. And, you know, some of the patients I've seen that not have been happy with long COVID, but see the bright side of those patients who have been suffering for years and really were dismissed and told, you know, it's all in your head. At least I think the awareness now is much, much higher than it's been in the past. That's true. And I think there's more, definitely more research now than there was, you know, 6 years ago on chronic fatigue syndrome. So I think that is another reason for optimism, not just for long COVID sufferers, but for others with chronic fatiguing and post-viral illnesses.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both of you for taking the time to come on the podcast. The people in Philadelphia are lucky to have you two guys out at Penn, great institution doing fantastic work. And I hope everyone who's listening will check in with their doctors or any research centers to get the best possible care.